This show proudly sponsored by Real American Freestyle Wrestling. Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Kilmeade. If you want something fun and easy to search for homes and apartments, then you should be using the Redfin app. Whether I'm searching for my next place, if I want to buy, if I want to rent, or if I just want to scroll through and see some dream homes, like, for example, something on the beach or at least a walk to the beach, a big house, second, maybe a third floor, I use the Redfin app. Redfin makes it fun to search all the homes for sale and apartments for rent in your neighborhood. You can filter for price, for beds, for baths, square footage, and so much more. So if you find a place you love, Redfin makes it easy to go see it in person. Just schedule a tour right from the app. Plus, if you're looking to sell, Redfin agents know how to get you the best price possible for your home. That's because they close twice as many deals as other agents. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin's fees are half of what others often charge, which means you'll have more money to put towards your next home. So whether you're looking to buy, you're looking to rent, you're looking to sell, Redfin's got you covered. Download the Redfin app to get started.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Wow, thanks for being with us all week long. It's historic week, so much going on. We have Senator Rick Scott in about 15 minutes and Dennis Ross. He knows more about the Middle East than anybody. He's been with Republicans and Democrats, major roles, major books. We have seen a total revamp possibly of the Middle East in real time. A lot has happened with the Abraham Accords, but this could be potentially even bigger. But I'd like to get a big picture perspective along with seeing about the missile strike, the rocket strike, the bomb. The direct bomb hit, the bunker busters, and the ramifications. We'll get through all that. And also, we're covering a few different stories. For example, the Supreme Court's got six major decisions coming out today in real time, and I'll cover them on the fly. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
And unlike the current mayor, I'm not going to be working alongside the Trump administration to build the single largest deportation force in American history. I'm going to actually represent each and every New Yorker, and that includes immigrant New Yorkers.
How about illegal immigrant New Yorkers, clown? Zohran Mamdani. Yep, tidal wave of panic as New York's mayoral primary has Dems in panic as radical socialist Zohran Mamdani wins that primary. A Uganda-born Nepo child with a radical Columbia professor dad. The party knows this model will do nothing but hurt their national perception and the possibilities in the midterms as Mayor Adams reignites his career and his hope for getting reelected. And Cuomo stays in.
Number two.
Mr. Leader, what about this provision that's getting chopped out from the parliamentarian?
You guys right here.
Everything is challenging, but they're all speed bumps, and we will. We have contingency plans, Plan B and Plan C.
They should be at least needing Plan B and Plan C. That is Senator John Thune, the majority leader. The parliamentary pranks. Looks like the parliamentarian pranks, I should say. It looks like the left-leaning ref of reconciliation is throwing sand in the gears of the Republican budget cuts, forcing Senator Thune to scramble to finish the big, beautiful bill as Trump awaits, ready to use his hammer or blow his top or both.
Number one.
Well, I will say that this was an extraordinary effort by the American military, following on several extraordinary efforts by the Israelis. We will eventually know precisely how much the Iranian program was damaged.
We will, Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State. The strike worked. Details and divisions have emerged on Capitol Hill over the Titanic Iran bunker buster blast. But one thing is clear. It was effective, despite what you might have read. But is the Middle East ready for a peaceful makeover? We'll examine. So when we went and saw that press conference yesterday, and I rewatched it, the thing that struck me most is that preparation for this hit in Iran dated back to 2009. You know, people want to say, well, Donald Trump's got a problem with Iran. No, Donald Trump doesn't have a problem with Iran. Iran has a problem with America since 1979. And you would think at a different time, a more sober time, that when we pull off this missile strike using the B-2 bombers on bunker busters, never been dropped before, biggest non-nuclear bomb in the history of the planet, and we do it with such precision, no deaths, just destruction, destruction of a nuclear program out for evil means. You would think you'd go, well, you know, President Trump, you pulled the trigger. But you know when it was dreamed up? 2009. Since that time, we've had George Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, Donald Trump. Say it's all of us. came up with this plan. They probably, all these people on the Intelligence Committee, Armed Services, they knew about this plan. They didn't know the detail. 21 to 26-year-olds pulled it off, men and women. I love the fact that we didn't make it a big deal. It was a female pilot. Why? Because we just want the best pilots. We don't care which gender they are. It's not significant because we want to get past all that. Hispanic, black, white, Latino, whatever. Let's just get the best people. That's what we got to go back to. So the question is, can you remake the Middle East? And I think it's possible because Iran could talk with all the bluster it wants. They're just not the same country. They got no air force, losing their top military commanders, their top intelligence commanders. They were just humiliated. They have absolutely no missile defense. You had 12 straight days of bombing raids, hundreds of planes over their head, doing whatever they wanted in their country, but blowing up installations, locations. Anything military, anything else was not intentional. Condoleezza Rice knows this military effort was huge. The execution was phenomenal. Cut 10.
Well, I will say that this was an extraordinary effort by the American military, following on several extraordinary efforts by the Israelis. We will eventually know precisely how much the Iranian program was damaged. But I think all of the evidence is that it was substantially, significantly damaged to the place that, for a while at least, it will be hard to build a nuclear weapon. And I just want to say, Brett, to have a low confidence assessment come out 24 hours later, it was kind of irresponsible. And so I hope people will put that aside and look at the overwhelming evidence that indeed this set Iran back significantly. It also changes the nature of the region, not just this event, though.
So she went on, and I'll play a little soundbite later, but you know what she said so important? Nobody ever gets public, low-confidence initial reports. How did that get out? Now, the Defense Intelligence Division, they're fine. But you know they also said that Ukraine won't last 3 days to a Russian invasion? How'd that prediction look? So it was their initial take. There's no way that should have got forward. The question is, who at DIA was so determined to get out this negative report, which is negative because everybody in America, clear-thinking person, wants everything to be destroyed and obliterated? But if you hate Trump, we got to get this out right away. So who do you call? Natasha Bertrand. Who is she? She was the person receiving all the Russia hoax stuff. She was the one with the laptop who got 51 intel agents say that his Russian disinformation was not true. Okay, but this big story about the Russian dossier, all the Christopher Steele determined to get the word out that the president's been bought and sold by Vladimir Putin. She wrote all that. So she was a great place to go if you are anti-Trump. And last night, I'm watching her again, and she's being highlighted on CNN now because Donald Trump thinks she should be fired. And she's out there saying low confidence. All these people say not much is damn. What are you talking? Well, we don't have anything certain. Why is the administration not getting more definitive plans? Well, have you noticed it's a hostile country? Have you noticed we haven't been on the ground? Even weapons inspectors haven't been on the ground. We can't just waltz in there, especially when we ended and had a ceasefire on the 12th day. But it was a phenomenal effort. But now, with that country on its back, with it humiliated in the region, unable, I imagine, to write checks to Hezbollah, Hamas, flow arms over to Russia, and the Houthis, not only are they not taking orders, they're not getting shipments. That is great for the region because Israel doesn't want to dominate the region. They just don't want people shooting at them, sending rockets at them in the north and south every single day. That's not really too much to ask. So we got to find out what the talks are going to be like. I thought it was interesting. The foreign minister spoke last night, and the foreign minister is different from the Ayatollah. The grand Ayatollah says, there really weren't too much damage, and we won this battle. And he looked shaky. He stuttered. And he looked terrible, like an 86-year-old whose country's lost, perhaps. But the foreign minister came out and said, no, it was substantial. Substantial damage. Cut 5.
I must say that the damage is excessive and serious. But for the inspectors to visit, that is a decision that must be made. And in my opinion, in accordance with the law of the parliament, the Supreme National Security Council should make this decision.
Guy's pretty calm. I'm sure they want to turn the page. I would actually welcome a dictatorship. And if the military dictatorships is an alternative, they're less fanatical religious zealots who think it's their godly, earthly duty to kill Jews and to wipe out the West. You don't really get that from military dictatorships. You know, you see what happened in Pakistan? It's not an ideal situation, but they go back and forth. I would take that just so they want to grow their country, educate their people, and be positive and be a positive force in the world. Biggest question, that's what Condoleezza Rice is facing. They have to answer these questions themselves. Cup 14.
But do they want to recognize the weakness that they now are enduring? Do they want to step back from their disastrous policies in trying to build a nuclear weapon, from their disastrous policies in what they call the Ring of Fire, these proxies that were terrorizing Israelis and others? If they want to step back from that, then perhaps there is a way for the Iranians to begin to reenter the international system. But I have my doubts given who they are.
Yeah, we've never been down this before, but she certainly knows the region. National Security Advisor, former Secretary of State, who is a Sovietologist, I think that's how you say it, which now became a Russian expert, now runs the Hoover Institute over at Stanford. When we come back, Senator Rick Scott, we talk about the big, beautiful bill, and we'll also talk about what's happening with Iran, as well as what does he think? Is Florida going to get a lot more New Yorkers now that they're on the cusp of electing a radical socialist as mayor? Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
It's the Will Cain Show. Watch it live at noon Eastern, Monday through Thursday on FoxNews.com or on the Fox News YouTube channel. And don't miss a show. Get the podcast 5 days a week at FoxNewsPodcasts.com or wherever you download your favorite podcasts.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
At a minimum, we have $46 billion of additional, I think, score dollars that would be on paper for the Green New Scam subsidies they don't want to repeal in the Senate. But in truth, we think that number is closer to $200 billion. Our friend Alex Epstein, who's an expert on this, if you look at the open-ended nature of these deals, it will allow these subsidies to go in perpetuity and would be disaster. But it's not just that. Like, we made all those improvements on food stamps. Guess what? The Senate is just undoing about $100 billion worth of those food stamps. And that's not the parliamentarian fully. That's choices that they're making.
And that's frustrated House members, conservative House members, who had a hard time with one vote margin handing the bill over to the Senate. But Chip Roy's frustrated. Is Rick Scott? Let's ask him. The senator from Florida joins us now. Senator, you heard what Chip Roy said. Did he have a correct characterization of where this bill's at?
Absolutely. I mean, first off, we don't have text. You know, Brian, we still don't have text. So we'll see what this is. But we have got to understand that, one, let's do the right things for the American public. We're running $2 trillion a year deficits. We have $37 trillion worth of debt. We had a 53% increase in spending in 5 years. And even the House bill cut it less than 2%. So we've got a lot of work to do. But one thing I'm really focused on is Medicaid. Brian, Medicaid is for poor kids. Medicaid is for, you know, disabled kids, disabled Americans, people with chronic illness. But guess where all the money's going? The able-bodied adults that don't want to work. There's a Wall Street Journal article today that said that, you know, these able-bodied adults that don't want to work, that we're giving them free health care.
Whoa. Aren't you doing work requirements? Don't both sides agree on that? Both chambers agree there's going to be a work requirement?
Brian, no, they can volunteer.
That's it?
They can just volunteer. Now, you don't have to work. Come on, Brian. Work?
Well, I thought that was already agreed
upon.
My
mom would be so mad at me if I didn't have a job. Get back to work and spend the money to help these poor kids rather than these able-bodied adults who want to spend their time watching television.
The reimbursement level's at 90% from the government thanks to Obamacare. But what about the green subsidies? People like Tom Tillis. Well, by the way, when it comes to Medicaid, you got Josh Hawley saying, don't touch Medicaid. That's what my people depend on.
I agree. We've got to spend money where Medicaid was intended. Poor kids. Brian, when my little brother, before Medicaid, had a bone disease and my parents had no money, they couldn't find anybody to take care of him. He finally went to a Shriners hospital 4 hours away. That poor kid might not get care today because guess what? They're spending all the money on able-bodied adults who don't want to work, and guess where all the money is going? They're going to California and New York so they can give free health care to illegals. New York gets $20 billion more out of the Medicaid program out of the federal government than Florida. Well, we have 4 million more people.
So the parliamentarian is not helpful. You tried to reform food stamps. It says you tried to stop undocumented illegal immigrants from getting Medicaid. She says that doesn't fall into reconciliation, the Byrd rules. Parliamentarian also ruled out an Obamacare payment change for plans that cover abortion. She also tuned out and crossed out when you guys wanted to stop using federal funds for gender transition. So what's going on here?
It's really disappointing. It's really disappointing that the parliamentarian gets to make these choices. But guess what? Guess what we could do? Don't allow the states to game the system. They're gaming the system to take federal tax dollars. The Florida taxpayers, which don't pay for this stuff, are paying for it in New York and California and other states. So stop allowing them to do it. We can fix all these things, right, by stopping this. But it's just a scam. Mm-hmm. Provider taxes. It's just a scam. Look, I get that, you know, my friends in the hospital business, you know, they want to make more money. I get it. I was in that business. But they're making so much money right now. Let's take care of the hospitals that are struggling. The rural hospital, that's who we ought to be taking care of. Poor kids.
But there is a fund.
Kids, chronic
but Senator
people,
Scott,
people
there is a
illnesses.
Fund. There is a fund for that they're talking about setting aside for rural hospitals, correct?
Absolutely. So that's why I said, let's take some money. Let's direct it to CMS so Mehmet Oz can direct it so he can look at the financial statements and say, where do these hospitals, which hospitals need help? So some of our rural hospitals are going to need help.
All right. Right?
And so let's help them. That's exactly what
I've been
pushing.
Are you in on these talks, Senator? Are you in on this, or are you just waiting for them to give you something?
We have conversations, but you don't know until they give you a final bill. And so, look, do I want to support a bill? Yeah, but could I support a bill that doesn't take care of poor kids, rural hospitals, doesn't take care of disabled kids or people with chronic illness? No. Can I support a bill that doesn't do anything about our $37 trillion worth of debt? I can't. Do I want to vote for a bill? You better believe it. But I want to vote for a good bill.
But how do you feel about entitlements being something you visit after this has passed?
What will be the pressure? There'll be any pressure. I mean, there will be no pressure after this. But what would be the pressure to fix any of it? And if we can fix it now, this is our chance.
Well, Social Security is under pressure. It's going to go bankrupt shortly, right, by 2030? So that would be pressure.
But if you want to fix Social Security, if you want to, you know, fix Medicare, get people back to work. We have 50 million people in this country, able. Well, I don't know if they're all able-bodied, but 50 million people working age, they're not working. Now, if you're disabled, I get it. If you've got young children, I get it. But guess what? Like I'm talking about with Medicaid, you just want to spend your time watching television? Get to work. Help build up our country again. Help make pay for the Medicare program and pay for Social Security program.
Well,
if we get people back to work, we can fix it.
So Senator Thune says, I got Plan B and Plan C. The president wants to get it done by July 4th. You don't want to let
Me
the
too.
President down. So how does this play out? We only have 30 seconds left.
So how it plays out is, you know, we're all going to see a bill finally when it comes out sometime. I don't know if it'll be today or tomorrow. And we're all the ones that, you know, want to focus on these issues. We're going to work hard to make changes. Look, I can't support something that doesn't take care of poor kids, rural hospitals. I mean, it's real simple to me. Brian, why aren't we doing that?
I don't know, Senator Rick Scott. That's you got the front row seat. We're waiting to see what is released out the window. Senator Rick Scott, thank you very much. It's going to be a lot of work straight ahead. Dennis Ross next.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
And so I think that issue does need to be solved in the context of negotiations. I don't think it requires military strikes. You wouldn't even want to do that, but they can be resolved in negotiations, and I think it should be a priority. And to both get the International Atomic Energy Agency involved to monitor whatever Iran turns over, but more importantly, the U.S. should have a mechanism to make sure that it's all declared and found and then removed. And that, to me, is something not to lose sight of.
So David Albright, the president, the founder and Institute for Science and International Security, known as a great weapons inspector, well-known during the Iraq years when we were trying to get that done. And he said that basically the damage has been substantial. And then where do we go from here? There's nobody better to talk about big picture than Ambassador Dennis Ross. Now he's William Davidson Distinguished Fellow, best-selling author. His new book is called Statecraft 2.0, What America Needs to Lead in a Multipolar World. Ambassador, for a guy like you who studies incremental progress and digression, what are your thoughts about a president that finally took the shot?
Look, you know me. I call him as I see him. I don't always support this president, but I will tell you what he did was exactly the right thing. And I'll tell you why, to me, it's so significant. We have had the Islamic Republic basically since 1979. It has engaged in actions, terror networks, using its proxies. It has gotten away with things with a kind of impunity. It created an image that any military action against it would create a regional conflagration. We would be sucked into these forever wars. And the last thing we should want, and everybody was intimidated by it, including every administration, even the Trump's first administration. So you go from 1979 to today, and finally we acted in a way that said, you know what, no more impunity. We gave you a chance to negotiate this. You didn't take it. We acted militarily. They are dramatically weakened. To be fair, it's the Israelis who did the vast bulk of dramatically weakening them. But the president, by acting militarily to take out these three critical sites, to reinforce what the Israelis had done on two of them, what he's done is he sent a message to everybody: Iran will no longer act with impunity. There will be a price. They're much more hollow than people think. It's not an accident that they always wanted to have their proxies fight and not them. And we've just demonstrated that, in fact, this is a regime that, whether it survives right now or not, it is not in a position to threaten the rest of the region the way it has been. Mm-hmm. Its proxy network has been decimated, and now they have been set back in a really dramatic way. Their weakness is exposed. So if you ask me in a word, I very strongly support what was done.
So tell me if this is significant in Dennis Ross's mind. The Grand Ayatollah comes out and says Donald Trump is exaggerating the damage done, and we won. The foreign minister comes out and says the damage has been substantial, and I'm not really sure where we go from here in terms of giving inspectors access. We'll turn that over to the Parliamentary Supreme Council or whatever they call it. So I see already a bit of a difference. Does it matter?
I think it does matter. Look, the Khamenei emerges, doesn't actually emerge. He's been in hiding. All right. I tweeted yesterday, you know, he's been in hiding. He sort of comes out. He issues a statement, declares a great victory. And I said, a few more victories like this and there won't be an Islamic Republic. All right. Let's just be clear. So the fact that the foreign minister is a little bit more open and I'll say candid about this is a reflection that even he knows, A, you can't fool the Iranian public about what the reality is, and B, what it says is there is a segment of the elite that says, look, we can't continue to fool ourselves, and we are going to have to find a way to deal with the outside world. By the way, it doesn't mean if a negotiation begins, which at some point it's likely to, it'll be easy. It won't be easy. Their DNA when it comes to negotiations is to give up as little as possible, to make claims, to show that they're not going to simply submit.
Right.
But okay, you'll go in understanding that.
So is the chance for something major. For example, they don't have the surrogates and they can't fund them. People focus on nuclear, yeah, but on a totally separate, more practical level, they've created the greatest unrest with the funding the Houthis, funding Hezbollah, funding Hamas. They made life hellacious for Israel. And thanks to Israel's incredible operations, from the pager to the walkie-talkies, to the brutal way they're fighting in Gaza, they have diminished that threat. The question is, has the money and weapons that were traveling there stopped because Iran is in such dire straits?
It'll certainly be dramatically cut back, for sure. Look, Brian, there's basically, we should think about it in the following fashion. Iran didn't create all the conflicts in the region, but it exploited every single one of them. Iran created this imagery, and it wasn't just image, of coercion. And then others were afraid to take certain steps because of the kind of threats that they would then face from the Iranians. They dominated four states. This was what they called the axis of resistance. I called the axis of misery, because every place where they were dominant, what you saw was states that were either failed or paralyzed. So we are in a different region right now, and there is an opportunity, I think, to try to take advantage of it.
How do you best do that? Because we know the foreign minister denied there's talks already set up, but let's say they're going to get set up in the next couple of weeks. Our goal should be clear. You got to stop funding the proxies, but there's got to be a way of following up, because we can never trust them. And number two, the nuclear program is a totally separate issue, and we're missing 400 kilograms of uranium that's enriched to 60% roughly. They got to come clean on that. And then you look around and say, well, what's left? And why do we even compromise with this defeated foe who is an enemy of almost everybody in the region, including the leader of Syria for the first time since we've spoken last? I guess Turkey is somewhat of an ally.
I don't know if they're an ally, because they've always been a historic competitor, but they're also not necessarily, even though they're part of NATO, they're not necessarily our ally. They're not the same. They're clearly not the threat that Iran was, and they do support the Muslim Brotherhood, and that's problematic. But the most serious threat to the region came from the Iranians. Their proxy network is now decimated. Their ability, as I was saying, to exercise coercion has largely disappeared. You'll see the Saudis and others will feel much more confident to take certain kinds of steps. There is an opening here. We should be focused on how do we build a new coalition that includes the vast majority of Sunni Arab states with the Israelis. That will redefine the landscape of the region. Mm-hmm. That will change the future. You will have to deal with the Palestinian issue. You can't wish it away. And you can't assume that somehow it doesn't matter at all. One of the realities, you made a reference to how the Israelis have fought in Gaza. We know who's responsible for that. It's Hamas is responsible for that. But the imagery, I've often said, when you go to the region, as I have multiple times since October 7, 2023. In fact, Brian, I was in Israel for the first 5 days of this war. And then I went to Jordan from there before I came home. There has been two different realities. In Israel, the Israeli public is traumatized by October 7th. They see the hostages and they see their soldiers lose, the loss of their soldiers. The Arabs don't see the hostages. The Arabs see the death and destruction that's been done to Palestinians. It has soured the atmosphere towards Israel. So you have to start by ending the war in Gaza. And you can, because one of the things no one is going to question, that if Israel gets out of Gaza, that if they see in any way Hamas beginning to reconstitute, they'll act again. No one questions that. Israel just demonstrated that. Israel now has an opportunity to work, I think, to accept the fact that there can be an interim administration in Gaza led by the Emiratis, maybe the Egyptians, a reform Palestinian Authority. Let this transitional administration be there for 2 years. Let that be the first step in a process that begins to deal with Palestinians so you can build something that's credible. Create what amounts to a coalition that further isolates the Iranians. And this is also part of your leverage in any negotiation. You're quite right. Look, they won't concede easily, as I suggested, but we sure as hell shouldn't. We're at a point now where we say, you know, we are prepared to make life much better for you. You know, we're not, as the president said, we're not about regime change. I don't like the term regime change anyway. Nobody's ever good at doing it from the outside. It has to come from within. There may be a regime collapse. Now, it's up to them. If they don't want the regime to collapse, it can't. Their instinctive answer is going to be repression. That's what they're going to do. Well, that actually may make them even more vulnerable.
Yep. And that means sanctions don't get relief. They don't get any sanctions relief, which means the economy is going to begin to collapse and contract even more. And then we pressure China to stop buying their oil. And we're dealing with China now. There are things that we can be doing.
100%. And I'm saying if the president wants to offer the Iranians something, which I think he does. I mean, this is the way he approaches deal making, where he puts a lot of pressure on, but then he offers something. Okay. There's nothing wrong with that as you approach negotiations, as long as you're very clear on what the requirement is. You know, good statecraft always depends upon marrying objectives and means, but it depends mostly on having very clear objectives. The very clear objectives right now have to be, you will not have enrichment. Number one, there'll be a very clear cap to your ballistic missile program. Number two, number three, there will be no military support, material support for the Houthis, for Hamas, for Islamic Jihad, for Hezbollah. That all ends. You know, you want to support them politically?
Right.
Okay. Whatever you say, that's fine. But not militarily, not financially.
And we have to have a way to enforce that effectively. I just want to see if you agree with Condoleezza Rice on this. Cut 17.
I'm very glad that there was also, as a part of this, a message about American credibility. You know, there have been a lot of people asking about, are we turning isolationist, et cetera, but here, the way that the American military performed, the decision to actually help the Israelis after they cleared the way, I think it really is a shot in the arm for American credibility, which I frankly believe has been suffering some since our disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. And so that's a very good thing as well. And I have to say, coming just before a NATO summit that was also quite successful in showing Vladimir Putin that, quite to the contrary of weakening NATO, he's actually strengthened it with new commitments to defense spending with Finland and Sweden in.
It's hard to challenge what she said, but you have a great idea. You have a great sense of perception from the inside out. What do you think?
100%. And I'll say it at two different levels. Level number one is, who exercised power, the United States or the Russians and the Chinese? Everybody in the region saw that. And number two, they saw that the use of American power was not just precise, but quite devastating. One of the things right now, I believe you'll see the Saudis and others, as I said, maybe they're not going to be lauding the Israelis because of the public mood, but they recognize right now Iran has been dramatically weakened. The Israelis did the bulk of that. But when the U.S. was needed to, in a sense, help ensure that this was completely successful, the U.S. was there. So I think our credibility has been enhanced. Mm-hmm. And I think that in the region, there's a great potential right now because we demonstrated that we will use power and not just limit it to words.
I love that NATO's reaffirmed. I understand people are uncomfortable with the fact that everyone's so nice to Trump. But he went in there saying, I don't really need this alliance. You need that alliance. And when it is, that's part of his negotiation. You read his books, you talk to him. I don't need this. I could walk away. The minute you show you're willing to walk away, that's when people got serious. And they did. I'm not sure how many are going to get to 5%, but a lot are going to try. And they weren't going to do that 8 years ago or 6 years ago. I'll add this, too. I really would love to see us back Ukraine. We're going to get them Patriots. It looks like it's great. I hope the president sees the benefit of backing Ukraine, because that also sends a great message to China. But I know there's a lot of people who have soured on it. I haven't.
I'm with you, and even for another reason. If you're really going to convince Putin to look for a way out of this war, he has to understand time is not on his side. Right now, he thinks time is on his side because we won't support Ukraine. And he thinks their superior size and resources will allow him to outlast the Ukrainians. If he understands that President Trump is saying to him, effectively, look, Vladimir, I like you, but you know what? I'm going to provide, I'm gonna provide military assistance to them, and that's gonna continue until you're prepared to end the war. As soon as I see you're serious about ending the war, then my approach might change. But right now, you've left me no choice. You want the war to continue? Well, the war's gonna continue at a very high price. I'm telling you, Brian, the costs that the Russians are suffering are not sustainable for another year. Putin thinks because we won't support the Ukrainians, they're not sustainable. So if the president really wants to capitalize on his credibility, now is the moment to convey to Putin, we will support Ukraine. I gave you, he should approach the Russians the way he approached the Iranians. I don't mean in terms of using force, but he said to the Iranians, I gave you a chance diplomatically and you didn't take it. And now you're paying the price. With Putin, he should do the same thing. I gave you a chance diplomatically, and you didn't take it.
Right.
Now I'm going to provide support militarily to the Ukrainians, and it won't just be patriots.
Great advice. I'm going to talk to the president in the Oval Office on Tuesday with my colleagues on Fox and Friends. So I'm bringing up Ukraine, and I'm going to bring up your name, and I'm going to bring up that offer. Ambassador Dennis Ross, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Brian.
All right, back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
But I'm going to be here to stand up and fight back. And unlike the current mayor, I'm not going to be working alongside the Trump administration to build the single largest deportation force in American history. I'm going to actually represent each and every New Yorker. And that includes immigrant New Yorkers. And that means standing up for the laws of this city, like our sanctuary city policies, which have kept New Yorkers safe for decades and were defended by Republicans and Democrats alike for years until we got this mayor who fear-mongered about them so extensively.
So that is the stunning news about a mayor race that everyone should care about. Zohran Mamdani is a socialist, basically communist, radical Islamist. It seems he is a Uganda-born, pro-Palestinian, started his own group in college. His dad is a radical Columbia professor at all the demonstrations, never really had a job. They have had a lot of money, which is fine, but now he's an assemblyman and 33 years old. Has done a great social media campaign, very comfortable in front of the camera, and now he is the primary winner, all but official. It happens July 1st. For the Democrats. Why is that significant? You only win if you're a Democrat, it seems. And number two is Cuomo's still in, lost, established candidate, blew a 25-point lead because he's a terrible person, horrible governor, but he had huge money, $25 million, and still lost, but he's going to stay as an independent. Eric Adams has breathed new life into his campaign. He was riddled with scandal. I don't know how much is legitimate, how much was targeted. But I will add this about Eric Adams. He is definitely an ally now of Trump. Trump and Tom Homan have told me they're very impressed the way he's taking control of the streets. He did put a great police commissioner. So he's got to rally and stop New York from being handed over to what London has, a radical Muslim running a major city in a free city, in a free country.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi everyone, so glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where there's a lot of interest in this this mayoral race. Now the Democratic nominee is the controversial one. Yuval David is at the bottom of the hour. He is Emmy Award-winning actor, director, filmmaker with over 100 international film festival awards, but very pro-Israel, pushing back against anti-Semitism. He'll be in studio. Congressman Claudia Tenney is standing by as we're starting to get the Supreme Court rulings, and it looks like Amy Coney Barrett has been asked to write the ruling that came out that would limit the power of district courts against the executive branch. And as we're interpreting it, and I'll wait until I get the exact verbiage, Amy Coney Barrett write it as if the injunctions that have been written against the president, the actions that the district courts have taken are overstepping. And the 64 injunctions that Trump has, that's been blocking Trump, some have been overturned, 22 in Biden's 4 years. He's got 64 already, does Trump. And we're only 5 months into his second term. It's pretty extraordinary. So I think this could be going his direction. I'll get some clarity on it. Congressman Claudia Tenney joins us now. Actually, she's going to be with us shortly. In the meantime, while we wait, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
And unlike the current mayor, I'm not going to be working alongside the Trump administration to build the single largest deportation force in American history. I'm going to actually represent each and every New Yorker, and that includes immigrant New Yorkers.
That is Zohran Mamdani. Tidal wave of panic as New York's mayoral primary has Dems wondering, are the radicals and socialists their future? Mamdani is both those things, and he beat an established candidate in Governor Cuomo. Ugandan-born Nepo kid with a radical Columbia professor dad, and he's everything his dad is, if not scarier. Mayor Adams has his new momentum on his reelection campaign. Governor Cuomo says, I'm going to stay in.
Number two.
Mr. Leader, what about this provision that's getting chopped out from the parliamentarian?
You guys right here.
Everything is challenging, but they're all speed bumps, and we will, we have contingency plans, plan B and plan C.
That is Senator John Thune. The parliamentary pranks. Looks like the left-leaning ref of reconciliation is throwing sand in the gears of the Republican budget cuts, forcing Senator Thune to scramble to finish the big, beautiful bill as Trump waits, ready to use his hammer or blow his top.
Number one.
Well, I will say that this was an extraordinary effort by the American military, following on several extraordinary efforts by the Israelis. We will eventually know precisely how much the Iranian program was damaged.
It is significantly damaged, and even the foreign minister admits that. The strike worked. Details and divisions have emerged on Capitol Hill over the Titanic Iran bunker buster blast. But one thing is clear. It was effective, despite what you might have read. But is the Middle East ready for a peaceful makeover? Maybe I'm being too optimistic, but I think so, because they've been so diminished. Before we get to Congresswoman... Claudia Tenney joins us now. Congresswoman, are you there?
Yes, here. Great to be on.
I know you got the legal background, and this ruling just came in. The Supreme Court just ruled 6-3 on limiting the use of nationwide injunctions that temporarily blocked enforcement of President Trump's executive order on birthright citizenship. So the ruling has filed three emergency applications challenging the scope of the federal court's authority. That's means something. To enjoin government officials from enforcing an executive order. So traditionally, courts issued injunctions prohibiting executive orders from enforcing a challenge law or policy only against the plaintiff in the lawsuit. The injunctions before us today, this is Amy Coney Barrett writing, reflect a more recent development. District courts asserting the power to prohibit enforcement of a law or policy against anyone. These injunctions, known as universal injunctions, likely exceed the equitable authority that Congress has been granted to federal courts. We therefore grant the government's application to partially stay the injunctions entered below. And then they talk about maybe the 64 that have been written against the president. From what you interpreted on the fly, what do you think?
I think this is great that we're realigning these overreaching Article 3 powers. As everyone knows, Article 1 is the House of Representatives and the Senate, the legislative body. And we have moved so far to relying so much on judicial remedies, and that these judicial offices and these appointments, you know, mostly by Democratic, almost entirely by Democratic judges, have gone well beyond their jurisdiction and well beyond what was conceived by Article 3 in creating these courts, and also creating the district courts, which do have somewhat of a limited jurisdiction. And that's why we have the Supreme Court to realign us back to Article 3. I was really pleased to see this. I'm a 6-3 decision. It should have been a unanimous decision, because the Democrats are going to, rule the day when this is happening against them, when Trump-appointed judges are doing the same thing. And I think it's a good realignment of the judicial system. I'm a lawyer, but I'm also the daughter of a New York State Supreme Court justice. So he would be pleased with this decision as well.
So, Claudia, a couple of things. Excuse me not being a lawyer, so I'll ask some fundamental questions that other lawyers wouldn't ask other lawyers. So how do you know? So, I have a case, and I have an executive order, and I sign it, and it's out there. And then some ACLU says, I'm going to sue you. I'm going to pick the court. I'm going to sue you. And there, I'm going to sue you. And the district court judge agrees with the ACLU. And Trump is stopped again. Now what changes?
Look, this is the weaponized justice system, but we do have an appellate process. That's how we had to go to the Supreme Court. You know, one of the frustrating things, and I've had cases go all the way up to the Supreme Court.
But it's such a delay.
Exactly.
Do we still have that delay?
Right. I think that you have to – this kind of case is a message to a district court judge.
Got it.
That you engage in this, you are going to be slapped down by the Supreme Court in the appellate process. Sadly, though, Brian, this is the problem. It takes a long time to weave your way through the courts. I started a case in federal court on behalf of a Native American client that I had back in, I think I started in 2008. We didn't even get to the Supreme Court or even considered consideration by the Supreme Court until 2017. So these things have to be expedited. The judicial system is way too slow, and that's a problem. And it also is costly. Most people, and there's all kinds of great meritorious cases out there that never get the light of day because the people can't afford to get a lawyer. It's one of the reasons I really support a lot of pro bono operations and a lot of non-for-profits actually help litigants who don't have the money to bring cases, and sometimes they're maybe on our side, say more conservative side, and sometimes they're on the left. But these cases are important to bring and be able to get some kind of relief from the judicial side. Now, my case ultimately didn't get cert because the Supreme Court only has that much bandwidth. But this is an issue, but I think it's a message to district court judges that you are exceeding your authority under Article 3 and to deter them from doing this. So I think it's great that the Supreme Court weighed in on this. There are other things I'd like them to weigh in on that they haven't yet that would actually prevent these types of frivolous lawsuits to come forward and also attempts to delay and undermine the power of the executive as well.
So the I understand it opens the way to pursue the executive order was written, birthright citizenship is banned. Of course, everyone starts suing, goes right to the Supreme Court. This opens the way to pursue birthright citizenship, birthright citizenship, which says that if you're born in this country, you become a citizen. Now, the thing is, we needed it when it was written because there's some segregationist racist that said, because blacks are born here and we lost the Civil War, we're not going to let them become citizens. And they said, okay, how about an amendment to the Constitution? They're citizens. They were born here. Understood. Now people are abusing the system. Chinese are coming here, having their kids, they become Americans, just to abuse our system, use our social welfare system, and in the case of the Chinese, infiltrate our system. People from other countries finding a way to come here illegally, having a kid, the kid's an American, the parent gets to stay. It's obvious for both parties what's going on here, the abuse of that language, which the president is trying to stop, but Democrats see it as, I don't know, they see that as a problem.
I agree with you 100%. I agree with the president here. Look, this is interesting, Brian. You're an historian. You know, all of this abolitionist movement and all of that was actually very much part of upstate New York history. So we had Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and others fighting for civil
and
rights.
What about Seward?
And ultimately leading to this.
Your former governor of New York, who was Secretary of State, Governor Seward.
Absolutely. But you can come to the Abolitionist Hall of Fame in Peterborough, New York, which nobody knows about. Why? Because a lot of people don't like the narrative that these Republicans were fighting for civil rights. They were fighting for the people to get their citizenship. So it's interesting. But back to your point, though, Brian, I think it is really important to show that this is being abused. The language is being taken wrong. And this, as someone who serves on the Intelligence Committee, it is often very, you know, just because you are born here, because your parents have come here, you could be an Iranian, jihadist or someone who, and you come here and have a child with no intention of really embracing our Constitution, our way of life, only to get that citizenship, to get extra protections and extra protections under the Constitution. So it's fraudulent. And I think that's the heart of what the president is trying to get at. And what you're talking about is gaming the system to take advantage and to really our enemies taking advantage of the system. You know, whether, you know, a Chinese national might be actually someone from the Chinese Communist Party who gets in here to go to a college. And all of a sudden, you know, the birthright citizenship brings their entire family in. And even though we're not really against their family, we're against the fact that they're operating of the Chinese Communist Party that is seeking to undermine the United States and our constitutional system, which has become so fragile. As Reagan famously said, you know, we're just a generation away from losing freedom. And you started off a little bit, I've heard of the beginning of your show, talking about this insane situation in New York City where we have a person standing up for communism, which is the direct opposite of what our founders saw, a person standing up for lack of tolerance, lack of civility. And here we are at this day. This is so important to protect our constitutional principles, which are complex, but also rely on a virtuous citizen, rely on freedom, and rely on really respecting human rights and respecting freedom and obviously the security that is brought by our constitutional principles.
And if you think that you have a problem with de Blasio, and I think he was the worst, and you don't think Adams is as good as he could have been, I think he's got more potential than most. I'm a big Curtis Sliwa guy. I hope a Republican has a shot. But listen to Zohran Mamdani yesterday, cut 36, about one of the top issues in cities, and that's illegal immigration, cut 36.
But I'm going to be here to stand up and fight back. And unlike the current mayor, I'm not going to be working alongside the Trump administration to build the single largest deportation force in American history. I'm going to actually represent each and every New Yorker. And that includes immigrant New Yorkers. And that means standing up for the laws of this city, like our sanctuary city policies, which have kept New Yorkers safe for decades and were defended by Republicans and Democrats alike for years until we got this mayor who fear-mongered about them so extensively.
Really? We were all for sanctuary cities. It was never an issue being abused by illegal immigrants in the beginning. Now it's totally morphed into something unrecognizable. But this is a little bit about what he would be like.
Yeah, this keep us safe for decades, sanctuary city policies. Look what's happening in New York City. I used to live in New York City in the 80s. I think it's more dangerous now than ever. Lighting people on fire on the subways. People are afraid in their own homes and their apartments. People are talking about, you're hearing realtors being interviewed today all over the news about their clients are like, hey, I want to put my condo or I'm going to get out of this place. I'm going to move. And we've already seen the mass out migration. There's no greater mass out migration than the state of New York because of the policies of the left. And, you know, we thought Andrew Cuomo and now Kathy Hochul were bad. This guy is dangerous. And I will say this is really important to anyone listening to this in New York City. The largest caucus in the New York State Legislature are the Democratic Socialists of America. They praise and talk about Karl Marx on the floor of our state legislature on a routine basis. That was not the way the legislature was when I was there. These people are radicals. These people are going to harm New York City residents, and people have got to wake up. I mean, this is this type of rhetoric, this type of anti-Semitism, what's been going on, this anti-American rhetoric, this anti-constitutional rhetoric. I mean, they're talking about praising authoritarianism, praising communism, which requires authoritarianism, taking away rights of individuals. Our country was founded on individual rights. It's individual rights, not this Marxist communist dream that this 33-year-old naive guy, or maybe he's not so naive, you know, who seems to be very charming, you know, is a snake oil salesman, as I think Mayor Adams aptly said the other day. But, you know, the people have got to wake up or they're going to leave. And guess what? New York City drives the economy of upstate New York. My district is way up in upstate New York, and there's all these movements to always detach New York City, but they've always been the drivers of our economy across the state. But if we lose our greatest asset, which is the economy, the economic economy of New York City, you're going to see the rest of New York State crumble even worse than it is. And these radical policies that are being run and put in place in Albany, by the way, a lot of moderate and so-called moderate Democrats are intimidated by this group because they take them out in primaries. This is the advent of AOC in 2018 when reasonable Democrats were forced out of their seats. And look at AOC. She campaigned with this guy. You know, she is an attractive, charismatic person, but she has radical ideas that are dangerous to the security, the safety, and the economic stability of our state and our country. And she's the new Bernie Sanders.
I know. And now they say that she's now a front runner to get the nomination, which is great news for Republicans because America is not squad free zone. I mean, is not pro squad. You know, there's a niche.
I'll tell you.
I don't see the country.
My new favorite Democrat Senator Fetterman said, he said, this is Christmas in July for the Republicans. Look, if this guy gets elected, it could be great news for us in being able to take back the governorship, maybe take some more seats in the Senate and the Assembly and the state level, and maybe take some more congressional seats back in a midterm that, you know, would be unusual against history. But maybe this is what could happen with the Democrats having no real American ideology, no real understanding other than embracing Marxism.
I hear you. And lastly, are you going to go for Lawler or Stefanik if they both run?
Well, let's see if they both run. I mean, I know they're both kind of like traveling the state and looking to see where they go. I like both of them. They're both tremendous members. Elise is kind of up in my area a little more, but I know Lawler for many years. I think both of them, probably my neighbor's dog would be a better governor than Kathy Hochul at the moment, but it would be really important to put somebody in place that could stop what's going on in New York State. And by the way, we have to get some more seats back in the Assembly and the Senate. All of this takes unity by the Republican Party, and I'm the chair and founder of the Election Integrity Caucus. Everyone needs to get out and register voters and get them to vote for common sense. I don't care if you register as a Republican. When you vote in November of 2026, vote for common sense, which is going to be a Republican. It's not going to be Kathy Hochul.
Congressman Claudia Tenney, so much going on, more decisions coming down. Also, some movement on the Gaza situation. Netanyahu and Trump just spoke, so they're coming forward with an announcement soon. Man, a lot going on. Congresswoman, thanks so much, and hopefully you guys can pass a big, beautiful bill this weekend.
We're working on it. July 4th is the deadline. I hope the president gets his wish and helps all Americans.
Back in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
50,000 people spending weekends, rain or shine. I mean, I went to some of these events and you kind of get the sense that people are there because it's fun, because they're there to meet people. The night of the election, by my estimation, there were probably 15 parties in bars across the city, young people getting drunk, you know, rolling joints, having the time of their life, chanting Zohran, Zohran, Zohran.
And that was Olivia Rheingold from the Free Press, who's been covering this mayoral race and watched the rise of Zohran Mamdani. She's one of the few people not surprised. She said, I could see this straight ahead. There was no energy, no events for Cuomo. But she also went on to say that if Cuomo did a ton of events, was in his prime, nobody was listening. It said people wanted something different. But don't think that she got young people with no op. He got young people, yes. But he didn't get poor people. He didn't get minorities. He did not get the black vote. Which is interesting, right? For a Democratic guy to win and not do all those things, people under $50,000 voted, who make that, voted for Cuomo. I'm not kidding. Back in a moment. More Supreme Court cases. Don't leave.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
First, let me say that I've always said that Iran can never have a nuclear weapon, plain and simple. President Trump said that the nuclear stockpile was completely and totally obliterated. I did not receive an adequate answer to that question. What was clear is that there was no coherent strategy, no end game, no plan. No detailed plan on how Iran does not attain a nuclear weapon.
Unbelievable. Senator Chuck Schumer cannot ad-lib a thing. Reading off his page, Jewish, the highest-ranking Jewish lawmaker ever, reading off a page saying there's no plan after. That's what they're trying to say, chaos. They don't know what they're doing. There's no plan. Senator Kelly, big disappointment, says the same thing. What are you talking about a plan? Get them to talks where they wouldn't go to talks. They do five rounds. The sixth round was going to be a waste of time. They had a plan, been working on it since 2009, constructed bombs just to execute it and take it out and sent a message. And now talks are probably going to get underway within the next 2 weeks. What do you need? What does he not know? Of course, we don't know the results of the bombing yet. We don't have people on the ground. I don't know if he's heard yet. But from what he sees in the video, the President of the United States has every right to say these installations have been destroyed. With me now is Yuval David, a celebrated Emmy Award-winning actor, host, director, filmmaker, has won over 100 international film festivals. But now you have a different focus. Am I right, Yuval?
Yes. I've always been a sociopolitical activist, and that ultimately started to lead to advocacy and being an advisor. So I now advise dozens of governmental and non-governmental organizations in the United States, Israel, and internationally, really focusing on that media training and how to craft the storytelling, because the public isn't getting it. We saw what happened here with the Democratic primaries. How can people vote for a socialist who calls for intifada, which means the radical, violent uprising against the institution of this country? It's wild.
So globalize the infantata. He goes, I understand it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he even defended that statement. So again, let me define intifada for all of your listeners. The word intifada means a violent uprising with terrorism in order to take somebody down who is not practicing in the Islamist manner. That's what that means. Intifada is not peaceful. Intifada is not progressive. But yet the Intifada and the Islamist movements have manipulated the progressive movements to believe that Intifada must be really great. It's horrible. And now Mamdani's the front runner in the Democratic Party. So what does that say for New York, and what does it say for Democrats?
Well, what does it say for the country?
Exactly.
Because it's not just – because we're national, even though we aren't WABC in New York. But around the country, the reason why it's a national story is because there's this group called the Squad, and they are ultra-left-wingers that President Trump likes to have fun with because their views are so radical and unaligned with the American mandate. And now she endorsed him, and they're saying that she's now a front runner for 2028.
Horrifying. Absolutely horrifying. Anybody who supports socialism needs to speak to somebody who escaped or survived the former Soviet Union or Cuba or Venezuela. Socialism does not work in a large country. This country was not built on socialism, and the great city of New York cannot thrive as a socialist environment. I don't understand what AOC, the Squad, and Mamdani really think other than being performative politicians.
Right. And by the way, we are following the story and the plethora of Supreme Court decisions, six major ones coming down today. One came before. Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that curbs nationwide injunctions. These district courts have been shutting down the president. He's got 61 overall. Put in context, there was 4 against Obama, 21 against Biden in 4 years. The high court has ruled now to limit birthright citizenship and rein in the power of lower courts to block presidential executive orders. So this goes down to a lower court to decide if you're going to come here and have a kid here, you come here illegally, have a kid, that kid becomes an American citizen. That was not the intent of the 13th Amendment. But just to go back to what we were talking about, remember you said globalize the infantata.
Intifada.
Intifada.
Yeah.
Just to show I'm not behind it, I have trouble pronouncing it.
Good. I'm glad you're not behind it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be on this show right now.
It's true. Here, this is Mamdani explaining it.
To me, ultimately, what I hear in so many is a desperate desire for equality and equal rights in standing up for Palestinian human rights. And I think what's difficult also is that the very word has been used by the Holocaust Museum when translating the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising into Arabic, because it's a word that means struggle.
So you want to take that on?
Because
the museum came back and said that is not true.
Right. The museum came back and said that's not true. Many people have come back and said that's not true. I'm a grandchild of Holocaust survivors and heroes of the war who lost the vast majority of their family, who were murdered by the Nazi regime. For him to compare Islamist terror intifada to Jews trying to survive and fight against Nazis to survive is not just practicing revisionist history, it's historical illiteracy. He's trying to use trigger words to activate people and trigger people in order to follow him.
Trigger anti-Semitism.
Absolutely.
So makes it okay.
He's part of what makes anti-Semitism normalized. Anti-Semitism is anti-Jewish racism. Anti-Semitism is anti-Jewish bigotry. Anti-Semitism is anti-American. Here's somebody who has been running for office who truly is anti-American.
So are you under the belief that with the operation in Iran, the takedown of Hezbollah, and the almost annihilation of Hamas – has changed the Middle East forever, or am I being too optimistic?
Because I
believe there is major change.
Brian, I want to join you in that optimism. I thrive on optimism. It's why I do all the advocacy that I do, because I believe in a better future. We're going to find out so much in terms of what will happen in the short term. I hope that the Islamic regime gets taken down and that Iranians themselves rise up and create a country that they had 50 years ago. It was an incredible country. I hope that they rise up and do that. I hope that we're all together able to take down Islamists. 25% to 35% of Muslims are Islamists. We need the vast majority of Muslims to rise up and say that the violent terror Islamist movement is not acceptable.
So how did Saudi Arabia do it? You know, after 9/11, we look at Saudi Arabia's Wahhabism curriculum and we said, oh man, the next generation is going to be just as radical as those hijackers. And they just stopped it. they seem to have altered their textbooks and curriculum in a way that they are now focused on at incremental steps,
right,
when some type of free market to a degree, diversity instead of just oil, a bunch of people going to college, highly educated, buying sports, slowly but surely trying to get women more part of a society. Yeah. So even though it's not American, the American way, we see positive change. So it shows you, you can you change the schools, you can change a country.
Absolutely. The schools in Gaza have been run by Hamas and UN organizations, UNRWA, that's been in bed with Hamas, where they've been teaching violent Hamas extremism as the norm. Even their math books show one infidel plus two infidels equals three infidels. One devil Jew plus two devil Americans equals, like, they've been indoctrinating people from a young age. So this is so dangerous. What we're seeing across the Middle East, probably due to the Abraham Accords, where people want business. People want to do well. The vast majority of people want their children to do well, to be healthy, to thrive within society. They don't want constant war. So Saudi Arabia is waking up and recognizing that the Middle Eastern mentality must change.
Yeah, and we'll see if it does. It's just kind of crazy because this happened in London. And almost every, you know, from the mayor on down, almost everyone is Muslim.
Yeah.
Now, I don't. If you're a Muslim, I don't care what religion you are. But if you're a Muslim with an agenda to forward Islam instead of trying to make London clean and run well and make it profitable, I got a huge problem with that. To me, this guy's got an agenda. He doesn't have a his vision is for something beyond making the trains run on time.
No, he's not trying to make the trains run on time. To be mayor of New York means you have to have the wherewithal to run the largest police department and fire department in this country. It means you need to be able to make the infrastructure work. To abolish ICE, to abolish and reduce money for the police and security services in this country would dramatically affect the 8 million people who live in New York City. This guy is running on a strategy where he creates really popular TikTok videos, but apparently that works.
But yeah, social media, he is. There's no doubt about it. He is phenomenal. I want you to hear Cut 35, because this guy, Bill Ackman, a self-made billionaire, has made it clear. He goes, I will put any amount of money into Adams or somebody else, because he was back in Cuomo. This guy, he's Jewish. He cannot be mayor. So this is when asked about this, Cut 35.
I'll meet with anyone. I will meet with them and I'll explain why I believe in the necessity of raising the top corporate tax rate. And I'd also tell Bill Ackman that I firmly disagree with his attempt to dismantle diversity, equity, and inclusion across the country, because it's not only against the morals of so many, it's also against the actual bottom line for so many businesses. And as a businessman, he should understand that.
So he wants DEI to come back? I mean, are you kidding me? Even Democrats are not doing that. Mayor Pete took his pronouns down and grew a beard. So this is something that I think Democrats like James Carville are saying, oh, my God, how did this happen? Bill Clinton praised him, though.
Well, that's one of the problems. When we see Democrats who have congratulated Mamdani, that shows that the Democratic Party doesn't really have control of their own messaging. That's a problem. Now, many of these Democratic leaders didn't endorse Mamdani, but they congratulated him.
Hakeem Jeffries, Senator Schumer.
Right. So is that the same thing? Does that mean that it's kind of an endorsement, but not really?
I think they don't know what to do. I think they're panicked. Another thing is, he's running against a candidate that couldn't be more defamed and disgraced. I mean, multiple harassment allegations, right, writing a book in the middle of a pandemic, right, screwing up the entire state, the nursing home deaths. And then he leaves his term early in disgrace. And now he says, what the hell? Let me do this. So that has a lot to do with it, too.
Absolutely.
You're talking about 400,000 votes to 300,000 votes.
Absolutely.
For a city of 8 million.
We need more New Yorkers to get out and vote, because this is a dire situation.
You know, there are more Jews here than any other place on the planet.
That's true.
Except Israel.
That's true.
What does that tell you?
Actually, let me give you even something more specific. There are more Jews who live in New York City than any city around the world, including Israel.
So what happened? Are you losing a whole generation
who doesn't
like Israel and doesn't care about their religion?
The progressive movement, which I used to be part of until I started to recognize years ago that the progressive movement isn't about progress. It's a regressive, or as I like to call it, the faux-gressive movement. It is a movement that has manipulated so many minds in the language of civil rights, social justice, and human rights, but it's going against everything that we should believe in. I'm an LGBT activist. I used to be an LGBTQIA plus activist until these letters kept getting added.
Yeah.
And you know what? And now it's really focusing on LGBT. But this is the problem. The progressive movement is being manipulated by Islamist movements because the leadership, we have to follow the money, the leadership are being bribed by so many nefarious people in order to manipulate the masses who then rise up and march in the streets and demonstrate with placard strategy. Because if a slogan rhymes, then it must be true. If a slogan can fit on a sign or a hashtag, then it must be true. We have become a nation of useful idiots, and it's people like you who are so important, Brian, mm-hmm. to relay information to educate the masses, because we need to be Americans who engage in sociopolitical activism.
And how about
That's
this?
What I do.
And how about this? We're coming celebrating America 250.
Right.
The president's got a lot on his plate, but the one thing I would love to see a curriculum starting in maybe fifth grade, third or fifth grade, where you talk about America in a positive light and a realistic light. So people grow up and they're 19 years old, and it's not the exception that's patriotic. It's the rule. The one that stands out is critical of the country. I think we grow up and we were watching a bunch of 21-year-olds who walk around saying, I apologize for what happened with the American Indians. I apologize for slavery. Excuse me? What did we do with the world? What role did America have in transforming freedom and liberty around the planet? And they have no perspective on where we're from because they've not been taught it.
No, they haven't been taught
it. It's too controversial, evidently.
Well, that's part of the problem with DEI, where it's the victimhood competition. Whoever is the biggest victim is the biggest hero.
Did you see Pete Hegseth yesterday?
Yeah.
When asked about the pilots, he goes, is it true? Why didn't you mention there's a female pilot? He goes, why would I?
Yeah.
Because it's just... she was a male. Obviously, when I said boys, I mean people that were executing the bombing raid.
And
that's who we want.
And
we
that's
just want people.
Exactly. That's a sign of success.
Yeah.
That's a sign that the women's rights movement has succeeded, that we now no longer have to say, oh, this is a male pilot or a female pilot. They're pilots. The same thing with the LGBT movement, the LGBTQIA plus movement succeeded. The Trump administration has so many lesbian and gay people as part of the administration. Actually, it has the most openly gay and lesbian people as part of any administration.
It's not important.
Right, because they're just Americans. They're just Americans who work for the government. That means that we succeeded. So the problem with these progressive movements, including my own LGBT movement, is that we succeeded and these organizations didn't know what else to do. So they had to find additional topics to address because they didn't want to lose their funding.
All right, Yuval, where can we see? Is there anything you wanted to promote?
Oh my gosh. Well, please follow me across social media because I get way too many hate messages on a daily basis. And I believe that we are the people who can shift the algorithms to share positive information.
Say something nice to them at Yuval David. thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Brian,
great
my friend,
to see
thank
you. Keep it up. Back in a moment.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Well, it's not over, but it'll be significantly curtailed. Jonathan just pointed out that Justice Alito says that there's some wiggle room here. That doesn't surprise me because the court, including Justice Barrett during the oral argument, seemed to be very sensitive to the downsides of potentially making a rule that said no universal injunctions at all. So I think there'll still be some wiggle room here. We shouldn't delude ourselves. Both sides do this sort of thing. I think when during the Biden years, it was pretty typical for right-leaning states and groups to go to venues like Texas to file actions that involved enforcement of the federal immigration laws bill. So, you know, this is a game that everybody plays, this forum shopping thing. Mm-hmm. In a way, if you're a lawyer, it'd be irresponsible not to play it if everybody else is doing it. But
so that is so one of the rulings that is one of the major rulings coming down. Six are estimated to be coming down from the Supreme Court today. So the Supreme Court's limited the ability of district judges to stop President Trump. That is what had the CNN writers write it. But it's really to stop the executive branch because it's going to transfer to other presidents. The other Supreme Court decision was just handed down, not big as big. By the way, that means for birthright citizenship, it's an executive order that a district court struck down that's making its way up to the Supreme Court. It's going to go down lower. Well, it's birthright citizenship. It says if you're born here, you're a citizen, which is fine if you were, it was 1865 and or 1870, and you want to pass the 13th Amendment to make sure slaves are immediately given citizenship. But in 2025, it's being abused by foreigners who come here illegally to have a kid calling an American so they get to stay. And even Democrats should recognize that, but clearly they don't. So that's what the president's hoping to get passed, birthright citizenship, along with the other 61 injunctions, many of which have been overturned already. But he wants to stop the next group. Also, the Supreme Court says school policy barring opt-outs for LGBTQ books, which parents want to do, violates religious rights. So you should and are now allowed to opt out of a book that violates your religious beliefs. There you go. Things are going the president's way early. Four more big decisions to go. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. Tommy Lahren's going to be at the bottom of the hour. Bill Malusian, somewhere in the building, will be joining us. The numbers at the border are stunning for him especially. You're talking about double digits of people getting into our country when it used to be 12,000 a day. Crazy. And if you showed up, if you just said, I'm scared, you're in. A lot going on today. We have Supreme Court decisions coming down. The Supreme Court has limited the ability of these district judges to stop the executive branch. In this case, it's President Trump, because we've seen 61 injunctions come their way. And then you transpose that a little bit further and you say one of the major decisions was, which I think one of the most impactful, is birthright citizenship. Most countries don't have it. I don't think anybody does, where if you're born here, you become a citizen. But if you're illegal, if you're the parents and you're an illegal immigrant and you have a kid, that kid's an American. Why is that okay? Ever. So the president says we're going to try to end that. It went right up to the Supreme Court. They tried to send out an injunction, said you can't do it. Now they go back down because now we're saying there's too many injunctions. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
And unlike the current mayor, I'm not going to be working alongside the Trump administration to build the single largest deportation force in American history. I'm going to actually represent each and every New Yorker, and that includes immigrant New Yorkers.
He's a good speaker, but it's what he says is the problem. Tidal wave of panic is New York's primary for Democrats. Has the whole party wondering, radical socialist Zoran Mamdani, what does his win mean? Besides good news for AOC, the Uganda-born Nepo child with a radical Columbia professor dad who wants to be a socialist and really aspires to be a communist, wants to have free supermarkets, free buses, and charge rich people more. Does that make sense to you? Mayor Adams reignites his campaign with new momentum. Cuomo is staying in, and Curtis Sliwa's chances have never looked better.
Number two.
Mr. Leader, what about this provision that's getting chopped out from the parliamentarian?
You guys right here.
Everything is challenging, but they're all speed bumps, and we have contingency plans, Plan B and Plan C.
Senator Thune, he's got in charge the parliamentary pranks. It looks like the left-leaning ref of reconciliation is throwing sand in the gears of the Republican budget cuts, forcing Senator Thune to scramble to finish the big, beautiful bill as Trump waits, ready to use his hammer or blow his top.
Number one.
Well, I will say that this was an extraordinary effort by the American military, following on several extraordinary efforts by the Israelis. We will eventually know precisely how much the Iranian program was damaged.
All right. There you go, Condoleezza Rice. She is encouraged because she knows what the Iran drama was all about. The strike worked. Details and divisions have emerged as on Capitol Hill over the Titanic Iran bunker buster blast. But one thing is clear. It was effective, despite what you might have read. But is the Middle East finally ready for a peaceful makeover? Iran has been the problem. I know not the only problem, but the financing of a lot of problems. Their goal, more than life itself, they wanted to end life for every Jewish person that they could, especially the state of Israel. So that's where we stand while waiting for the Supreme Court decisions to come down. But just to give you an idea of the potential, almost everybody listening to me right now, our whole adult lives has been one Middle East mess to the next. What is everyone's problem with Israel? The 67 war, the 48, there was a war in 48, 1 year after being born. 67 almost tore them apart. 73 cut the country in half. They win all these wars and take buffer zones back. And then there was an 80 in Lebanon. And finally, that horrific October 7th, 2 years ago. But the results have gone Israel's direction and took Prime Minister Netanyahu from vilified, I think, from an all-time high. I haven't seen the polls, but who can see the way he's conducted these conflicts and not be impressed? He's just got to figure out what's going to happen in Gaza. In terms of what's going to happen with Iran, that's going to be our thing as much as their thing. Here's Iran's foreign minister. Now, I don't know. We don't have the Ayatollah, do we? We don't have the Ayatollah, but maybe we can get him because translated, he says Donald Trump exaggerated the bombing damage on the nuclear power plants and they were victorious. Really? The Iranian foreign minister didn't get the memo. Cut five.
I must say that the damage is excessive and serious. But for the inspectors to visit, that is a decision that must be made. And in my opinion, in accordance with the law of the parliament, the Supreme National Security Council should make this decision.
So, wow, not even saying the Grand Ayatollah, the National, whatever that is, that Security Council will make that decision. He's a foreign minister, their version of a Marco Rubio, their Secretary of State. Khomeini's pre-recorded speech that aired on Iranian state television, his first appearance since June 19th, they say was filled with warnings and threats directed towards the United States and Israel. You know, he's 86. He's known, we have to take their word for it, as a skilled orator, known for his forceful address to the country's more than 90 million people. However, in this appearance, he looked more tired than just a week ago. He had a hoarse voice and occasionally stumbled over his words, which is rare. Listen.
They attacked our nuclear facilities, a matter that is independently worth pursuing for prosecution in international courts, but they failed to do anything significant. The president of America greatly exaggerated what had happened. It became clear that he needed this exaggeration.
What do I say? Did you see the damage? Did you see the bunker busters? Did you see these are the most powerful bombs ever dropped non-nuclear in the history of the planet? He went on to say they could not achieve anything significant. Really? Nothing significant. Okay. He went on. It was a 10-minute video. No mention of their nuclear program and the status of their facilities and centrifuges. I'm not sure this guy's going to be in power too much longer. What's great is Bruce Pearl, who's going to be on with me on One Nation, coach of Auburn basketball. Khomeini put this on X. My congratulations on our dear Iran's victory over the U.S. regime. The U.S. regime entered the war directly because it felt that if it didn't, the Zionist regime would be completely destroyed. It entered the war in an effort to save the regime but achieved nothing. I don't know what planet he's on. I know you got to spin things, but at least make an effort to be somewhat glued in reality and give your people a little bit more credit. So Bruce Pearl took on Khomeini and said, liars and terrorists will not be trusted. I pray you keep the ceasefire so people in the Middle East can go living and build on President Trump's Abraham Accords. But don't think for one second you're fooling anyone. The world knows you still want a nuclear bomb and is watching. Yep. They also deepened their alliance with China, Iran's defense minister making his first foreign trip since the recent 12-day clash. He's headed over to China. I don't know if it was predetermined because his visit to Russia prior to the bombing, they said, was already scheduled. You don't have to say that if it's not true. So I think that China already showed that their support of Iran is extremely limited. What they want to do is a bond is buy their cheap oil. 90% of their oil sales go to China, and they're more than happy to buy cheap oil from Russia and cheap oil from Iran. But when it comes to weapons, when it comes to missile defense, there was nothing there. Nothing there at all. So that's interesting. Daryl Kimball is a nuclear expert, arms control associate. He spoke with Jennifer Griffin about the highly enriched uranium and how people are worried about the 400 kilograms that is out and about. But if you're going to go into talks with them, the first thing we got to demand, where's the enriched uranium for?
From a scientific perspective, how would you move the 60% highly enriched uranium? Like what kind of containers or what? How sensitive is that?
So in gas form, these things can fit inside cylinders that might look like
a water heater, right, in a house or scuba tanks. So, you know, they're highly movable. It doesn't require that many vehicles to move it. You know, there's no radiation that's leaking that requires special protection. There has to be protection, basic protection. So it is not that difficult to move. It is very difficult to power down, package up the centrifuge machines, however. So it is unlikely that, you know, Iran was able to salvage workable centrifuge machines before these strikes from Natanz and Fordow.
What a shame. So, yeah, find the uranium, and this should be rounded up. But the major problem with them as a major nuclear power for now is over. When we come back, I'll take some of your calls, 1-866-408-7669. Tommy Lanner will join us for a few minutes, and then we'll bring in Jim Trusty to unwind some of the decisions that are coming down from the Supreme Court. Exciting day. So glad you're here. And don't forget, One Nation, Sunday, 10 p.m., amongst my guests, Hugh Hewitt, Larry Kudlow will be with us, Bruce Pearl will be here, Tommy Lahren, and Sid Rosenberg will all be on the show Sunday at 10 on Fox News Channel.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So Bill Malusian's here. He's got a few minutes before he has to go back to Los Angeles and try to lower everybody's taxes and get men out of women's sports. Could you do both those things, Bill?
I'll see if I can make it happen overnight.
Right.
Yeah, I'll talk to Gavin.
Great show of hankering everyone's show, as well as firming on a panel. So, Bill, we've got three major – we have three Supreme Court decisions coming down. That's big news. We got the president trying to get the big, beautiful bill. That's big news. But he has great news that he has not really, in my view, taken total advantage of. And that's the whole shutdown of the border.
Yeah.
You were just sharing some numbers with me on how dramatic the change has been over the last 4 months.
It's remarkable, and I think his biggest campaign promise that he's delivered on, and fast, right? So under the worst year of the Biden administration at the border, 2023, there were an average every day of 1,800 gotaways slipping into the country.
We see them on video. We don't stop.
Yep. They're seen on video. They're seen on sensors. They see footprints in the sand. But agents are so overwhelmed, they just can't get them. So remember that number, 1,800 a day in 2023. June this month, that number is now 38 per day.
The whole
border. The whole entirety of the nearly 2,000-mile-long southern border, 38 per day. Brian, you can't fill up a school bus with that number. That is a 98% drop from the highs of 2023. None, basically. The Border Patrol chief, we just had him on this morning, Mike Banks, he told me since January 20th, since Inauguration Day, 14 illegal immigrants have been released into the U.S., and those are only for medical reasons or, like, public interest reasons, like they want somebody to testify in a trial or something like that.
So,
14 in 5 months.
And how do you think they've done it? What's the main thing that they've done? What role has the military played?
Military and consequences. That, remember, as soon as the Biden administration came in, what did they run on? They were smiling every time they said, we got rid of every Trump border policy. We're going to stop building the wall. We're going to put a 100-day moratorium on deportations. We're going to limit who ICE can arrest. Mayorkas himself said just being in the U.S. illegally doesn't mean you should be deported. So it became a very friendly environment to migrants, and migrants talk, right? They see it on social media. When people start coming across the border and they're getting in and they're waving sometimes to our cameras, it's easy. And then they're getting 5-star hotels with you guys here in New York City and free bus rides. So what happened immediately upon Trump taking office? He ended all that. Catch and release is over. He brought the military down. Catch and release is over. So now when people walk across that river and they step foot on U.S. soil, instead of being released into the U.S. with a court date 7 years away, they're immediately going into CBP detention. If they can't be immediately sent back to Mexico and they're from somewhere else, they're going into ICE detention, and ICE is sending them out, and they might be sent to CCOT. They might be sent some. They're seeing these images of guys with their heads being shoved down, shackled behind their back, being sent to El Salvador. Now we have a flight trying to go to Sudan. Do you think if you're a young military age man wanting to cross the border right now, now's a good time to try that?
Not in a million years.
Not right now.
It's amazing how it ripples down, doesn't it?
And the biggest thing is the word of mouth and how quickly that has changed. Trump is seen by the migrants as being mean when it comes to the border and immigration. You know what? From their perspective, maybe he is, but it's working.
What about the cartels?
They still have to make money somehow. They're still trying to get their drugs and their people in, but they got to be taking a huge hit, Brian, because the amount of fentanyl being seized has dropped like 50% already. The amount of people coming across the border is – it's completely fallen off a cliff. In December of 2023, we had 300,000 people come into the country in one single month. Last month, we had, I think, 8,000. I mean, it's. I knew that it was going to drop if Trump won. I never thought it was going to go this low. No way would I think that 38 gotaways along 2,000 miles is possible. That's think about that. From Tijuana to Brownsville, Texas, 38 right. people slip across.
So what is that doing for the border communities? I mean,
I'll tell you, they love not having dudes in camouflage running through their front yards every night. They love not having CBP helicopters flying above their homes every day, looking for people hiding in their backyards, trying to get away from Border Patrol. And that was happening every day, every hour at times. I can't tell you how many times I'd be down in McAllen or Roma or Eagle Pass, these communities right on the river. Where these gotaways would slip across the river. Border Patrol's too busy processing a group of 500 to 1,000, waiting to put them on a bus. There's no agents to catch these guys, and they just go running through people's homes. You'd find them lying under people's cars. Sometimes they'd break into ranch houses. They'd take people's food. I mean, that's all done. And you wonder how – like, look at what happened in the election, right? All southern Texas used to be blue. It all flipped red. It all flipped red because Trump was promising mass deportations and a secure border. That's a Democrat area, and those Democrats wanted border security.
Henry Cuellar is about the only guy,
yeah.
right? Congressman Cuellar seems to be sincere. He's also pro-life, but they always try to primary him on the left. Do we need the wall?
We do. It's a force multiplier. It's not realistic to think we're going to have a wall from every inch of the border from San Diego to Brownsville. But you need it in certain areas because it funnels people and it's a force multiplier. So there are areas where you can use mountains, you can use bodies of water as natural defenses. But in these wide open areas where people can come across, you do need a wall because what? If there's a wall there, then they're going to have to try to go around elsewhere. Right. You create choke points and that wall is it's essentially a big long Border Patrol agent there.
Are we ready to go? Any of the other stuff usable that's been rotting for
a lot of that has been sold off. So there's still some of it left that's been rusting, but remember, they sold a lot of this stuff off for like pennies of the dollar. They did not want that wall. Now, I'm sure they're going to source it in other ways, and they're going to get that material, and they're going to find a way to do it. But I mean, U.S. taxpayers spent hundreds of millions of dollars on that wall. It was bought and paid for. And with the stroke of a pen, the Biden administration said, nope, we're done with it. It's not happening. They let it rust out for years, and a lot of it got sold off to different contractors.
I'm sure you've seen it, and you covered the riots in Los Angeles.
Yep.
People want to say it was Trump made too much of it. It was just a few blocks. What's the reality, Bill?
It was in significant chunks of downtown L.A. I covered the L.A. riots in 2020, the George Floyd riots. I think it was right to bring in the National Guard because they waited too long in 2020. And by that point, Santa Monica burned down, Long Beach burned down. Santa Monica still has never recovered. Beverly Hills was getting hit, Rodeo Drive. They didn't nip it in the bud quickly. So did he call them in pretty early this
sure.
time? Sure, yeah, but look what was happening. Border Patrol agents were having rocks thrown at them. There were concrete blocks being thrown through Border Patrol van windows.
And ICE, right?
ICE as well. Agents were being attacked. And he has a responsibility as the commander-in-chief to protect his federal, you know, his ICE officers, his CBP officers, the federal buildings, which were being attacked. They were literally being laid siege to. And so, yeah, he sent them in. And notice everything calmed down after that.
Are they still there?
They're still there.
So I imagine that they're going to be pulled out soon. I don't know if they're going to make a big deal of it, but the courts upheld that he has a right to do that.
They upheld he had a right to do it.
Don't you think, Bill, that's a great message to Seattle and Portland and these other cities, with Chicago, that if you don't control your streets, that the federal government can and will?
And I interviewed J.D. Vance in L.A. last Friday. He was out visiting some of the Marines and soldiers. That's exactly what he said, is other cities should take note of this, that exactly what you just said. If the locals aren't willing to take care of their own streets, we're going to do it for them.
Yeah, and which is amazing. You would think they'd want to. Bill, you've been on the air so much, but when's the next time we could see you?
I'll be in New York again, I believe, mid-August.
So mid-August, so it's in person, but we'll see you all over the channel.
I'm on air all the time. Yeah, I don't know where I'll be. They got me moving around all over the place.
He's doing an incredible job. Bill Malusian, thanks.
Thanks, Brian.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Right. Birthright citizenship, in terms of the merits, will have to wait until a later decision that's going back down. The issue here is whether the court was correct in issuing a universal or national injunction. The court here says that the government's likely to prevail on that issue. It fails to see where these district courts get this authority at all. And that led to a really uncommon exchange between Justice Barrett and Justice Jackson. And Justice Jackson's opinion, she goes into rather hyperbolic language that this is going to result in our collective demise and basically the fall of our institutions. Justice Barrett would have none of that and went after that dissent and basically suggested that the danger to democracy is judicial supremacy. And really sort of castigates Jackson for that language.
So that is the big news when it comes to the injunctions. And there's been 61 on the president already. There was 20 for Biden, 4 for Obama. And this is president's only 4 months in. The Supreme Court has said, yeah, way too many injunctions. The district court is overstepping their bounds and doing this, whether the lawsuit's brought up to them, how they're going to adhere to it. They're reexamining all the injunctions right now. And Jonathan Turley just broke it down. So Tommy Lahren's here. She's going to be on with us on One Nation this weekend, host of Outkick. Tommy Lahren is fearless, her show. Tommy, we're not lawyers to break it down, but I'll say this. Trump's going to have a press conference. He is quite happy because the injunctions were driving him crazy.
And from my understanding, which is limited because I'm not a lawyer, right? From my understanding, this doesn't necessarily solve the problem, but it expedites what should be the president's agenda. So that's why it's such a huge victory. I think those of us who are waiting for a ruling on birthright citizenship, we're really excited for that. And we probably should have known we weren't really going to get that part of it. This was just the more overarching issue. But I hope we get birthright citizenship a ruling at some point too, because people were very excited about that one, myself included.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is what they also said. While the court has limited the use of nationwide injunctions in general, how this could apply to the birthright citizenship executive order is unclear. The justices order the lower courts to expeditiously decide how the ruling would apply to the particular plaintiffs, because let's say it's the ACLU. Enforcement of the executive order is stayed from taking effect for 30 days. So it goes down to reevaluate.
Yeah.
But we all know it's being abused. We all know that it was for slaves in the 13th Amendment. We all know it was because some racist segregationist said, I don't think my slaves should be citizens just because we lost the war. So they made it an amendment. And that has nothing to do with Guatemalans coming over here illegally where they can have 4 kids and call them Americans and they get to stay.
And they also get to take advantage of services and their family members as well. So
China
that's where
is
you
the
get
the biggest abuser.
Right. And you get a lot of people who were living off of entitlement programs through their American born anchor babies, which is a big problem. Going back to the actual opinion, though, I think the biggest news out of here, and I don't mean to be dramatic, but I think it's like the catfight between Coney Barrett and Ketanji Brown Jackson, KBJ. The words exchanged through the opinion and the dissent there, those were fighting words. Like, that was a little nasty.
Yeah, you know what? I'd be doing the show. I did not read it. I did not see that they were going back directly on each other.
Oh, boy.
Through the dissent.
Yes. Pretty spicy. It was spicy. And this stuff isn't normally spicy. But for me, I was like, okay, this is some Bravo in here, some reality TV, some Real Housewives of the Supreme Court. But essentially, what was said by Justice Barrett was, you're saying that the executive is not supreme, but you want the judicial to be supreme. That doesn't work either. And this whole KBJ of it's a constitutional crisis, as Jonathan Turley was pointing out, this exaggerated, well, the court, you know, made such a mistake and this is a threat to democracy. In essence is what she was saying. It's much the same drumbeat that the left has been giving us for the last at least 2 years. And I think it makes her look ridiculous and silly. And I'm glad that Justice Barrett really slapped her down on that.
And but because President Trump called her out, he says he's disappointed behind closed doors with some of her decisions. And now she not only made the decision, she wrote the opinion. So I think that's important. So let's talk about the big, beautiful bill. It's not written yet. It's not done. And this parliamentarian who decides if this really falls under reconciliation, for layman means essentially with Senator Byrd made a rule. You don't need 60 votes when you use reconciliation, but it's got to be involved with the budget. Fiscal, it's got to be a fiscal issue. The parliamentarian comes out and says, you know, when it comes to limiting Medicare and Medicaid to illegal immigrants, that shouldn't be in the bill. What are you talking about? Of
right.
course it should be in the bill. So they've stopped about a dozen different measures that the Senate's put in there. And it's making them really scramble. And it's making people like Senator Tommy Tuberville say, maybe we should just fire this Senator Reid, Harry Reid appointed parliamentarian.
Yeah. And again, the left is going to spin this because they love it. They love to make everything look like a constitutional crisis and an authoritarian regime. That's how they'll spin that.
Right. Elizabeth McDonough is her name.
It is utterly ridiculous. I'd also say the Democrats are running away with this whole we're having cuts to Medicaid and Medicare and granny's going to get tossed off and the people that really need it are going to get tossed off and they're going to be in a death spiral of despair. But they refuse to acknowledge the waste, fraud, and abuse that exists within those systems. It's actually robbing people who deserve it from actually getting the benefits that they're going to need and future generations that are going to need it. So to me, that's been the most frustrating part. And I don't think Republicans have done a good enough job of clearly pushing back against that.
Do you think that the fact that it has not been in the news much has helped or hurt Republicans?
Helped. But I think that everyday Americans, when you start talking about the big, beautiful bill and reconciliation, they don't really know what that means, nor do they care. They want to know if they're going to have no tax on tips, no tax on Social Security, no tax on overtime. They want to know if their tax cuts are going to be extended. There are some people that are very concerned about the whole SALT aspect of all of this. And also the Medicaid and Medicare, they're concerned about it. I think they want to see when it's actually in front of them, because right now it feels all very abstract.
I think you're right. I think that they must be happy. They just want the economy that they had with Trump. Now they say, you know, why are prices not coming down? Well, they're not going up. Inflation has basically stopped. Number two, gas prices are down to 2021 levels and probably going to keep going that direction to the point where we might be able to start replenishing our oil, our gas and oil reserve, which is fantastic. So I think that'll be a positive when we actually get to do some of these pipelines and start implementing the offshore drilling and get the natural gas over to our best customers who are called our allies, who the auto pen decided to cut off from during the Joe Biden years. They cut off our allies. But Chip Roy is upset with the Senate side. Listen to him about what he's seeing. Cut 28.
At a minimum, we have $46 billion of additional, I think, score dollars that would be on paper for the Green New Scam subsidies they don't want to repeal in the Senate. But in truth, we think that number is closer to $200 billion. Our friend Alex Epstein, who's an expert on this, if you look at the open-ended nature of these deals, it will allow these subsidies to go in perpetuity. It would be disaster. But it's not just that. Like, we made all those improvements on food stamps. Guess what? The Senate is just undoing about $100 billion worth of those food stamps. And that's not the parliamentarian fully. That's choices that they're making.
They're also, the new Green Deal, they're not unwinding it to a big level. You know why, Tommy? Because these plants, the battery plants, the electric car, they're being built in their state. So if you're Tom Tillis and they're building, Ford's building the Ford Lightning in your backyard, and you go, well, you know, we're cutting that off. They go, okay, I'm probably going to lose my Senate seat. That's what they're saying.
Well, my state of Tennessee made a big investment in that as well with the EV batteries facilities for Ford. I think that's going to be a flop. I think at the end of the day, everybody wants things for their state, but people are not buying electric cars and they don't want them. The demand is not there to really legitimize and validate a lot of these subsidies. And a lot of people don't talk about this because it's very in the weeds, but the carbon capture pipeline stuff and the credits that go to that, that's still, to my knowledge, left in to this big, beautiful bill.
Why would we do that?
Well, because companies like it, because they can get these credits, they can get these subsidies for this carbon capture. They can say that they're helping the environment. They send their carbon capture to some underground whatever. It's not even really proven to be an environmental savior. But again, these subsidies are very attractive for companies and corporations, and it's really unfortunate. A lot of it is stripped away, but not enough.
So you have a lot to do. You have to do Outnumbered.
Yep.
And you're going to play yourself on that show, right?
I am.
You are. So that's going to be 12 o'clock at on Fox. But then what are you doing Sunday at 10 o'clock?
Well, I'm going to be back with you, of course.
Well, on One Nation.
On One Nation.
And you're going to play yourself on that show, too.
I absolutely will.
Wow. I can't wait to talk to you. We're going to be doing a media segment where we evaluate how well the media is doing. They had a very bad day, I think, on Monday.
There are some doozies
this week
that I'm very excited to get into.
Right. I'm glad you made the language palatable for our audience, doozies. Tommy Lahren, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, when we come back, Jim Trusty unwinds the latest Supreme Court decision. You'll listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Increasing your intelligence quotient.
What the hell did you just say?
It's Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
We are back, everybody. President of the United States having a press conference now. He is so elated about the Supreme Court decision in particular that really pushes back on the injunctions that are stopping his agenda from district courts. 61 in all. They're going to all be examined, including birthright citizenship. Let's bring in Jim Trusty. Jim, always great to get your legal mind exercised. I know you had a chance to just digest it now. Your thoughts about the opinion that Justice Barrett was asked to explain and how she's brawling, basically, with Justice Jackson on her decision. First off, what does it mean?
Well, on the brawl, she's winning because it's 6-3.
Right.
But, I mean, look, the interesting thing is this is a 119-page opinion. It really doesn't address the substance of the issue of birthright citizenship. But the reason it got to the Supreme Court at this juncture was these district court nationwide injunctions being issued like candy. And, you know, President Trump has lived it. He had 64 injunctions in his first term. He's had 40 in 5 months this time. So this was a ripe fight. And, Brian, I would just say that, you know, this judge is, I think, Justice Coney Barrett and the rest of the majority, they looked at it and they said, look, this is, you know, Gulliver's Travels. This is a constant stream of manufactured emergencies with forum shopping where people find the judge they know they're going to get a sympathetic and activist ear from and pushing to handcuff the presidency. So it's not a big day about birthright citizenship. That issue will still be on the table for a while. But it's a huge day in terms of telling district court judges you've got to calm down, stop creating these emergencies, and stop going beyond the powers that the Constitution gives you.
Okay, a couple of things. On birthright citizenship, it's one of the executive orders that was stopped by a district court that was working its way up the court system, and the Supreme Court says, okay, we're going to have a 30-day stay on that. But that would be eligible to be reexamined, right?
Yeah, the substance of that is still coming, you know, and it's going to start with district court hearings. So we really don't have a great way of gauging whether the president's going to have any success on that. It's a little bit uphill. There's a case from like 100 and something years ago that makes it pretty clear that the exceptions to birthright citizenship are very narrow and don't seem to be the same as the president's view. So that kind of exciting, interesting issue, an academic issue, is still on the table for a while. It'll make its way through. But this was a broad message to all the district court judges on this issue and others to stop creating kind of emergency special jurisdiction where you issue subpoenas that handcuff the entire federal government.
So right now, I just don't know how it is applied. For example, president writes an executive order tomorrow or on Monday, hands it up, and then somebody, ACLU, says, I got a problem with that. So it goes to the courts, and they pick the court. What changes?
Right. Well, again, it's not automatic. This is more like advising all of these lower courts rather than creating a strict rule of law. What they're basically saying is you better have exceptional circumstances to issue an injunction that goes beyond the parties that are in your court. In other words, if you've got a single illegal immigrant litigating something, that's the only person you're affecting when you do a preliminary injunction, not the entire, you know, ICE deportation system. system. Now, I think it does get interesting if it's a class action. There's some suggestion from the opinion that a class action might open up the door for a nationwide injunction. But again, a class action is something that normally takes some time, where the parties come in and say, we're going to have to certify this class to the satisfaction of the judge. You know, some of the recent litigation, Brian, you had an attorney stand up in court, I think it was for the Maryland father, quote unquote, where he said, I represent an entire class. And they said, well, who's your class? He goes, well, I haven't talked to any of them yet.
Right.
And somehow that sailed. So it's kind of an amazing concept. Normally it takes a while to get your class certified to the satisfaction of a federal judge.
So do you think
it
would stop people from filing the suit because they know what the Supreme Court feels and where it's eventually going to end?
You know what? Sadly, probably not. I mean, this is lawfare, and this is just the same, you know, kind of manipulation and inventiveness that we've seen for President Trump, you know, to a much stronger degree than any prior president. I mean, President Biden complained about a Texas judge and nationwide injunctions, but it's not anything to the volume and the significance of what's been happening with this president. So, no, but it's a good reminder to district court judges to stop being activists, to stop expanding your constitutional powers because you don't like President Trump. And at least it sets up the reversals eventually on the merits. In other words, if a district court judge does this, the Supreme Court says, we're willing to wade in, and right now we're giving you a warning shot, but the next one might be a lethal shot.
Well, President calls it a monumental victory. Is he overstating it?
If he's calling it a monumental victory against nationwide injunction by single judges, he's spot on. If he's trying to say it tells us 100% where we're going on birthright citizenship, that might be optimistic. But again, I think he's focusing on the nationwide injunction, and I think he's right. This is the cost of lawfare. It bubbles up. It creates pressure for a normally reluctant Supreme Court to weigh in early and say, stop the shenanigans.
The Supreme Court has ruled that parents have the power to opt their children out of reading LGBTQ plus themed storybooks that may conflict with their religious beliefs. It's a First Amendment clash over required public school instruction. 6-3 was the ruling, authored by Justice Alito. Surprise?
No, and I got to tell you, this one hits home, Brian. I live in the People's Republic of Montgomery County. This is Montgomery County,
Maryland.
That's
where it emanates.
Yeah, and here's the crazy thing. You know, they are basically saying we want to subject kindergarten, first grade, young children to sexual education that indoctrinates them on the idea of different types of, you know, homosexuality, et cetera, transsexuals, et cetera. Starting point for most parents is, why the hell are you even talking to my kids, you know, my kindergartner about this stuff in the first place? But what Montgomery County did is they originally let parents opt out. You could say, I'm going to hold little Junior home today because I really don't want him exposed to any of this nonsense. They fought all the way to the Supreme Court to be able to say parents cannot opt out children from mandatory sex ed as a child. I mean, that's a crazy leftist position. It's an embarrassment to be from Montgomery County when they do this. And the only part that shocks me is that the three liberal justices presumably somehow found it okay to force kids to attend that type of indoctrination.
We're expecting some other major deals, but unfortunately I don't have any real estate left in this hour. James Trustee, can't thank you enough for joining me.
All right, buddy. Good to talk to you.
I appreciate the instant analysis. Also, don't forget to watch One Nation Sunday at 10 p.m. We're going to have a lot of great guests, from Larry Kudlow to Sid Rosenberg is going to be here. It as well. We'll break down all the big news, all that's important on Fox News Channel. And don't forget BrianKilmeade.com to see me on stage August 23rd in Dallas, Texas.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
Hey there, it's me, Kennedy. Make sure to check out my podcast, Kennedy Saves the World. It is 5 days a week, every week. Download and listen at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.